kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education 101. That is episode 101, not some kind of ultimate guide to digital education on this day. I am Di Barnes and this is...
Doug Balshaw. So this isn't room 101 either. It's not an introductory guide. It's Di and Doug pontificating about all the things. And now that we're over 100 episodes, and thank you for those who got in touch and sent their warm wishes. Some people, I think we need a special shout out to some people, to be fair. So as I mentioned to you, Di, when I was at the conference last week, I caught up with a few people who listened to Tide. Yeah. So One person in particular needs a shout out, I think. And so there's Helen DeWard, and she's listened to lots and lots of episodes of this podcast. But the person I really talked about is Christian Friedrich, who is a German guy who has fantastic English, better than mine. And he now works for Wikimedia, the Wikimedia Foundation in Germany. And he's got a podcast called the FOE podcast in German. And he said that he often uses some of the stuff that we talk about as a starting point for his podcast. So, and then another person, I think John Heffernan, hi John, if you're listening, he said he'd listened to, I think, all 100 episodes, which, oh my goodness, that beggars belief.
That does beg a belief, John. What the hell are you doing with your life, man? Well, it's nice to have you along. And we've talked to John along the way, tweeting in this way and that way. Yeah, so if people are listening and they're enjoying it, that's great. What a pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. And I'm always amazed when people say that they enjoy this podcast. I guess it's just listening to us to rabbit on about the stuff we're interested in. So... what have you been up to since we last talked? I was in Delft in the Netherlands last time we talked.
You were in Delft in the Netherlands, yeah, lovely Delft, which was, I've been living in the place that I live in all of the time, and I visited nowhere. Well, I did actually. It's my father's birthday yesterday, so I drove up to Hull, which is about 2.25 hours drive from here, for a 2-hour meal to celebrate his birthday, and then drove back again. I thought was a really good son thing to do.
That is a very good thing to do. Happy Isn't birthday, yeah. Mr. Barnes Senior.
Thank you very much to Mr. Barnes Junior. So that was very nice. And a beautiful thing happened there. As I was driving back, it was just the end of the evening and the sun was setting. I was driving out west, and it's a beautiful thing to drive into the sunset. But technically speaking and educationally speaking, I have been handing out Surface Pro 4s to our staff, which is nice, and giving them some training as we go. So it's always a pleasure to do that and just to talk through the different bits of the device, but really to give people, for the first time in my career, a computer that I really think will ease their lives, make it better.
Cool. You know, so you're not only just giving them out, but you really recommend them as well.
I do, not for a computer scientist particularly. I wouldn't want one. Sounds a bit weird, but my job is not a computer science teacher. Well, it is, but it's not, you know, it's to do it for what's right for people. And I think the Surface Pro is a really lovely device to use, has a nice, beautiful 2K screen, has a nice keyboard that's pleasant to type on. It has this inking facility as well, which I think will prove useful to many, especially the equation based subjects of maths and sciences and such like, electronics and things, as they learn how to use it. So I think it's really cool, and it's just quite exciting to actually get something moving in the digital strategy, really.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy with it. Yeah.
Good. Well, talking about laptops, you know, the Dell XPS 13 that I have talked about at length on this podcast and how I dropped it.
Yes, the £950 screw laptop.
Yes. So Dell, even though I took out, you know, the expensive 3-year on-site warranty, were going to charge me £950 because I dropped it and the hinge came loose by a single screw. Well, my wife, the lovely Hannah Belshaw, said, why don't we claim for it on our house insurance? And they couldn't have been nicer. I cleaned and, you know, cleared everything off my hard drive, erased it, got it back to fresh, sent it off, and they said, yeah, that's fine. And they're basically going to give me cash for a new one.
All right, okay, which obviously
minus
you don't have
the
to buy.
£100 excess of the, you know, £1,650 I originally spent on it. So the ironic thing is I've been enjoying using my Lenovo X220 laptop so much that I've decided I don't actually want a new laptop, so I'm going to buy a HANA one instead. Well, given that she does work for my company and, you know, for the co-op, it seems like a reasonable thing to do.
So what does HANA want?
HANA wants a MacBook. So just to say that the laptop she's got, it was like the one that I had at Mozilla, the second one I had at Mozilla. So a properly pimped out, fully spec'd Intel i7, 16 gigs RAM, that kind of thing. So we looked at that, and the similar one is about 2,100 on the refurbished store. So we're going to go for that. And then she looked at the MacBook and just decided, actually, I want that one instead.
Cool, which is the right decision.
Yes, I think so. Because, you know, it's horses for courses, isn't it? As you say, she's not, you know, going to be doing video editing. She's not going to be editing podcasts. I actually think like a Chromebook would be perfect for her, but whatever.
Hmm. I agree. It would be, but it doesn't matter. People like
no, it doesn't.
Have,
it doesn't.
People like to have and nice actually, quality hardware. That's the thing.
Sorry, say that again.
People like to have nice quality hardware. So that's one of the things about the MacBook Pro when I first got one, which I think was 2010. And that was the first time I spent any, what I would call serious money on a computer. And yeah, it was just the quality of the hardware I really appreciated. It was just, it looked nice. It felt nice. It worked nicely. Just opening it up and plugging things in and all that kind of thing. The trackpad was beautiful.
Yeah.
Keyboard was lovely, you know, just everything about
and
it.
And the reason, I mean, and you're right, it's horse for courses. The reason I like the X220 is because it has user replaceable parts. I replaced the screen, for example. When I dropped that one and cracked the screen, I got a new screen off eBay and replaced it myself, which if I can do it, must be easy.
Absolutely.
Got lots of user upgradable parts. It's fast enough for me. Like it's an i5 processor, et cetera, et cetera. And also, it's got a proper keyboard. It's not like one of these chiclet kind of keyboards. It's one that you can actually type on properly, which is a touch typist is kind of important. And the battery life's fantastic when I got a new extended battery.
Cool. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I do think that is the case, especially if you're going to run Ubuntu and things.
Yeah. Then, well, that's the thing. The older the hardware you buy, the more compatible it is with Linux.
There you go. Nice. Buy old computers, everyone.
Trailing edge innovation for the win. There used to be a blog, I don't know if it's still there, called Low End Mac, and it was all about running old Macs, you know, because they're built well. I used to get some value in that. I don't know if it's still around.
Don't know.
Anyway, I mentioned that Hannah does a lot of work for the co-op, and she does some great stuff. And the co-op, as of today, May the 1st, 2018, is 2 years old. Whoop.
Whoop, whoop. Happy birthday to the co-op.
Yes.
My father was 79. That's a little bit older, I guess. But 2 years old. That's good. The co-op's still going, still up and strong. Original members, still the same lineup, or has it got anyone new in it?
Well, funny you should mention that, Di. So Brian Mathers, John Bevan, Laura Hilliger, and myself were the founders. And then today we are announcing that Gronje Hamilton is joining us as a full member, as a director, as a member of the board, which is great. So I know Gronje from when I worked at JISC, and also she did some work at Mozilla, and she worked for Digital Me, if you remember, that was then acquired by City and Guilds. And then she's left there and she's doing some freelance work and joining our co-op, and she is fantastic. She's already done some work for us. She's curating Badge News. She's done some work with Bibliotheque Friesland in the Netherlands, and she's going to be doing some upcoming work around a digital literacy MOOC with the smart city of Beersheba in Israel for us.
Excellent.
And in the next few days, I was hoping I was going to be live for today, but there's some tweaks I need to be doing. We've got a new website because, as you can imagine, when you're setting up a new organization, you just throw anything up. And now we've got something which is a bit shinier. And Laura from the technical side and Brian from the artistic side have been working on that.
Oh, cool. Sounds good. Well, Gronje, if you're listening, hello. I'm Di. We've never met, I don't think. And although have we? Maybe I'm wrong. No, I don't think we have, but I'm really jealous. So they're four very good people, as I'm sure you're aware. So I'm sure you'll enjoy working with them.
Yeah, and it's an interesting process because when you want someone to join, the thing that everyone has in common with the co-op initially is me. And so you kind of, everyone else kind of wanted to trust me, but also we wanted a process because, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot, I'd want to make sure that, for example, Laura or Brian or John or Gronje were bringing in people who, you know, you could trust and everything like that. So we had to have a process that was lightweight enough to not put up unnecessary obstacles, but also make sure that the person wasn't just going, oh yeah, I'll join your co-op. So that was an interesting journey she went to.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Brilliant. Take me to Utopia, why don't you?
Well, just very quickly, I'm not going to go through it, but I wrote a blog post. I haven't written on my main blog for ages because I've been, you know, doing the floor shrapnel thing and basically riffing off other people's. But I was at that conference last week, the one I mentioned, OE Global 2018, and there was a great presentation. It was like a series of people from CUNY in New York, and this particular one was in Brooklyn, the City University. And they were doing all this open source technology and stuff. And one of them introduced herself by saying that her area of specialty was utopian studies. And I thought, oh my goodness, like I need to think more about that. And I thought, what would utopia look like for me? Because there's a book that I've actually got around to ordering now called Utopia for Realists. And utopia is often used as in a dismissive way. It's often used as a way of saying, oh, well, that's just a utopian idea. Like as if, but I think that you need to know what a utopian situation would like for you. So I just spent some time thinking about that. And yeah, there's some thoughts there.
Do you want to know, people, what utopia would look like for Doug?
More practically, Moodle is hiring a technical architect for the project that I'm leading. And I haven't done much hiring in my career, I have to say. It's always been something that's kind of been done for me. So I'm really excited. And this technical architect role is a 6-month kind of contract position in the first instance. You can be based at the new office that we're opening in Barcelona, or within 5 hours either way of UK time, because I need to be able to liaise for at least 3 hours a day, I guess. And it's interesting because the job advert really went out on Friday and hasn't really been pimped very much, but we've already had 6 applications and at least 2 of them look fantastic. So I'm talking to some people this week and just getting to know some people, because I think hiring people is a very social thing to do. I think we make it very formal, but you know, getting to know somebody, deciding that you want to give them some money to unlock their talents is a social thing.
I agree. Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I think the key to any organization is good recruitment.
Yeah. And if you don't get the right people in, then it's difficult. Mm-hmm. So yes, that is that.
Cool beans. Well, apply for that job or don't. We'll see who you take on. It'd be interesting.
Yeah, don't apply for it if you're just gonna like, you know, get your LinkedIn CV and just like whack it in with 2 paragraphs saying how you're the best person in the world. Like spend some time if you're gonna apply for it, like with anything.
Yeah, no, I'd spend some time. So first of all, what you need to do is ken up on co-ops, and then you need to analyze Doug's interpretation of utopia.
Yeah.
And then apply for the job after that. That's going to be the way forward, I think.
Well, I think I said last week that we're actually having one of the co-ops within the Co-Tech network running the design sprint at the end of the month.
All right. Okay. That's nice.
Yeah. Outlandish. They're fantastic. Outlandish.com. So, and we got several, three different kind of quotations. And they were the best and most detailed and kind of, they did the best job on that. So, yes. I mean, I used to think that the point was to try and minimize your biases. But I think as long as your biases are towards something which is adding value to the world and kind of pro-social, then those biases should be factored in rather than removed.
That's a fair point. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Cool. Well, exciting times.
Yeah, it is. It is. So I put some stuff in here. I don't know that you always say, let's go through them in order, but sometimes we don't get to the stuff at the end. So is there anything which kind of jumps out at you on here?
Everything is potentially
Here we go.
A meme. Well, I started reading it from the bottom up because you said that. And it's the penultimate.
Oh, that means I have to then copy and put. Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, you see, it just gives you something else to do.
Well, the other thing we could do is, you know, every week when we don't get to stuff, we could go back to the previous week
Cool. Happy days. We could do that. Okay.
Well, have a look at last week's and have a look at this week's. And like one of them, how to be super productive, is on both.
It is indeed, isn't it? Ryan Holiday's 13 daily life-changing habits.
Oh, you'll love these. You'll love these.
Okay, go on then. I love things I love.
Let's see how many of these things that you do, Di. Right.
Yeah.
Do you want to read them? Shall we go through them in the classic Tide style?
Indeed. Number one, prepare for the hours ahead.
Number two, go for a walk.
Number three, do the deep work.
Number four, do a kindness.
Number five, read, read, read.
Six, find true quiet.
Seven, make time for strenuous exercise.
Eight, think about death.
Nine, seize the alive time.
10, say thanks to the good and bad.
11, put the day up for review.
12, find a way to connect to something big.
13, get 8 hours of sleep.
So in the article, he goes through these in a bit more detail, explaining what he means. But on face value, what do you reckon, how well do you think you're doing on Ryan Holiday's lists of how to be daily, you know, these daily life-changing habits?
Can I just ask, is this nothing to do with Ryanair?
Ryanair?
Yeah, Ryan Holiday.
Who is Ryan Holiday? Holiday, who wrote books like The Ego is the Enemy and The Obstacle is the Way and The Daily Stoic.
That's, well, yeah. So, yeah, no, okay, fair play.
But I can see where you're coming from, Ryan and Holidays.
I know, I thought that's why I thought it was funny. Sorry, Ryan, if you're listening. prepare for the hours ahead. Yeah, I do that every morning. Go for a walk. I agree with that. I go walking lots. Do the deep work. Yeah, maybe. I don't really know. Probably. I do try and do the work that is most important to the things that I think are most important. Do a kindness. I don't do that consciously. I am quite a kind person, I think. I don't read enough. I read too much on what I would call transient material, you know, of the minute material, rather than reading the things. I don't pick up my books enough, so let's put it like that. Find true quiet. I do yoga every week, so that's part of what I do, but I don't meditate.
Yes, but these are daily habits, Di.
Oh. Well, that's why my life hasn't changed then.
Right. If only for yes.
Make time for strenuous exercise. I fully agree. I enjoy strenuous exercise, but I don't make enough time for it, although I do try and do something every other day. Think about death. I don't do that. Seize the alive time. I don't do that, although I do appreciate being alive. Say thanks to the good and the bad. I do that. Put the day up for review. I don't reflect on my days much, I don't think. I could do that more. So to the extent of action. So I do think about things that I could do better, but then I tend to just forget about it. So find a way to connect to something big. Yeah, that's probably a good idea. And get 8 hours of sleep. I'm sure that's a good idea. I'll let you know when I get there.
Do you sleep well usually?
I don't have any issues with sleeping. I enjoy waking up.
Cool. Good. Well, as I've put in this post, like I feel like I'm doing okay on a regular basis with most of those. But like you, I don't feel like I put the day up for review, which is something actually I have done in the past on a monthly basis. There was a time, and I the way that came from, I haven't done this since I think I was teaching or something like that. It's been a long time anyway, but I used to call myself into the office. And the reason for that, as I explained in the original post I did like 10 years ago, was that you haven't always got a good boss. You haven't always got someone who's going to give you the feedback. So sometimes you need to call yourself into the office to almost give yourself a monthly performance review or whatever. I don't think that's what he's getting at here. I think he's more like just reflecting on like what went well, what didn't go so well, how you could improve, whatever, on a daily basis, which is probably like a couple of lines in a journal.
Yeah, I think it's, so I'm going to equate this to, if you think about each day as doing a roly-poly down a hill, you know, just rolling down a hill, right? And I'm pretty good at stopping and whilst I'm rolling and like just taking in my surroundings and enjoying what I'm doing. But I'm not very good at thinking, should I be rolling down this hill? And then I just start rolling again.
Is this the right hill for me? Are the hills available?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's that sort of thing. I could walk. I could build a sledge. Or I could do something, you know. And yeah, so I think that's a necessary thing in my life. I'm not very very good at cracking the egg and, you know, just doing something a bit different. Mm-hmm. And really reflecting on. So I know in the back of my mind there are things I think, well, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And you really should be making more of an effort in this way. And then I just don't do it. Not so good.
Well, you know, not everyone's the same. I get bored easily. If I was talking to someone today about kind of career stuff, and not from my point of view, I was the one giving the advice about, you know, getting towards 2 years and, you know, getting the 2 year itch in a job, which I think is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, actually. I took Ben, my son, to go and get some football boots at the Metro Center just before, and he doesn't often see people going to and from work because we live in a place where we walk everywhere and we never travel at peak, you know, rush hour. And he was just seeing all the traffic jams and stuff. And I used it as a kind of a teachable moment, a learning moment of like, you don't want to be doing this, son. You don't want to be driving to and from work. Yeah. You want to be just deciding where you want to work today, working remotely. That's what you want to do. That's the game.
Yes, do what I do, son. yeah, okay. I'm sure he's thinking, yeah, you've just been on aeroplanes all over the bloody world for 2 weeks.
Well, so, exactly. You know. So that's Ryan Holiday's list.
Well, I think that's quite good fun, really. I mean, it's quite good. It's pretty obvious. It's like, you know, be nice to people, learn, do stuff with your body, think about the real world, you know, and yeah. And go to
bed. If you like that article, you're going to really like this one on how to be super productive, Di.
Oh my gosh, super productive.
That's right, not just productive, super productive, because everything has to have super in front of it these days.
It does. I noticed that. I was talking to a French person and they in French for a little while. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they kept saying super instead of mega or very or something. but they say super. No, it's all good. Okay, so what's this all about?
Comes from an article. Where was it? I think it was the Harvard Business Review, and I found it on Ian O'Byrne's newsletter. Thanks, Ian, for sharing. And they say, quote, we collected data on over 7,000 people who were rated by their manager on their level of their productivity and 48 specific behaviors. Each person was also rated by an average of 11 other people, including peers, subordinates, and others. We identified the specific behaviors that were correlated with high levels of productivity, the top 10% in our sample, and then performed a factor analysis, end of quote. So,
excellent.
7 things came out of the study as being correlated with, I mean, it's quite a small sample, really, 7,000 people, but here are the 7 things that came out of the study. Number one. Set stretch goals.
Number 2, show consistency.
Number 3, have knowledge and technical expertise.
Number 4, drive for results.
Number 5, anticipate and solve problems.
Number 6, take initiative.
And number 7, be collaborative. So that's great.
Yeah.
But I think you can boil those down even more, in my experience, to just 3 things, actually. I'd be interested to see what you think of this. I reckon showing up, being proactive, and collaborating. I think if you can demonstrate a track record of showing up, no matter how you're feeling, being proactive and getting stuff done, even when no one's asked you to do it, and collaborating with people and not just like working for your own glory, then that's the kind of people I have seen be successful in life and also the kind of people I want to work with.
I think that's true, but I think he's trying to go for more detail in that. So I think I appreciate you're trying to condense these, but I think the stretch goals are really important because things that don't stretch are dull. No, they're not. Sorry. But you know, it's like, it's the principle of set yourself goals that push you beyond your comfort zone, that take you somewhere new.
That's the kind of thing I'd cover with like being proactive. So instead of like being told what to do, you see something needs fixing, or you think that the organization should be moving in a certain direction, like, get on and do it. Like, just set yourself some targets and get on with it.
No, I think that's right. I could do a bit proaction in my life, I think. Or is it Prozac? I could do it. I'm not sure. Be consistent. Yes, I think being consistent is important. People knowing who you are and what they're going to get when they talk to you, I think is important. Knowledge and technical expertise, I think, are very important. Drive for results. I think being focused on results, like knowing what results you want.
Well, I think it goes into what you're saying about getting the right hill to roll down, doesn't it? Like, if you get results in an area that doesn't really matter, then who cares?
Indeed. Anticipating solving problems is important, and taking initiative, which is covered, and be collaborative.
Yeah, there we go. So I think my takeaway would be, like, just instead of using have a business review jargon, show up, be proactive, and collaborate would be my mantras, I think.
Cool. Fair play.
Yeah, there's not lots of stuff in here about education this week. Sorry, it's just the stuff I've been reading, I guess.
Well, we could talk about what the benefits of reading aloud to children are.
Well, we could, I guess. Let's do that.
That's an educational thing.
So I would like to frame this by asking you on your experiences of kids with ADHD.
All right, okay. I don't have that many. With ADHD, I'm just trying to think. I have a dozen, maybe more children, but not many I've been really had to work really closely with. I've had, so I've found that any child with ADHD that I've had the pleasure of their company for any significant amount of time, I've found them to be no different to other children. It's just the way that they express that is different, possibly, and or the way they express their dissatisfaction. And so I've seen kids who are on Ritalin and interacted with them, and when they've not had their Ritalin, and it's been a difficult thing, and it's been a clear difference between them on the drug and not from day to day. But I think it generally boils down to, and this is my naivety talking, my ignorance, I think, and I'm not pretending any otherwise, is just that it's just care and attention. Seeing the individual has always made a big difference. And I have, so a colleague of mine here is doing a PhD on using sport to combat ADHD rather than Ritalin. That's quite interesting. Right. But other than that, and Louis Theroux's documentary, I know very little about it, really.
Yeah, well, me neither. And I don't. So let me just say what. Let me just go through what this American article in the New York Times by Perry Class, MD, medical doctor. There's a particular study: 675 families with children from birth to five, and she describes something called a video interaction project (VIP). And this was originally developed 20 years ago, in 1998. And it says, participating families received books and toys when they visited the pediatric clinic. They met briefly with a parenting coach working with the program to talk about their child's development, what the parents had noticed, and what they might expect developmentally. And then they were videotaped playing and reading with their child for about 5 minutes, or a little longer in the part of the study which continued into the preschool years. Immediately after, they watched the videotape with a study interventionist who helped point out the child's responses. So this was in, it started out in kind of low-income urban families in New York from birth to three. And when there was this intervention of basically parents being shown how much their kids on the video signaled that they just loved playing with their parents, when there was this intervention, they were significantly less likely to be aggressive or hyperactive than three-year-olds in the control group.
So are you making the association with ADHD, or are they?
Well, I think that if you talked about kids who are aggressive or hyperactive in a social setting, then...
Then ADHD is fair shout. Yeah. Okay, so this to me is blinking obvious, I feel. However, it might not be, it might be more obvious than I had thought. Do you know what I mean?
So, well, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, like, you don't want to say that anyone's a poor parent, yeah? Like, not very good at parenting. On the other hand, like, if, as you have said, if you spend time with somebody and, like, pay the attention to them, it seems like some of these behaviours seem to reduce.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, one of the things, one of the burdens that I feel working in a boarding school, and I live in a boarding house, is that the pupils that I live with, a lot of them want my time and attention, and I'm happy to give it to them. They're very amiable young men, and but I don't have the time to give to them, and I also have myself to look after, and I'm very conscious of, you know, because we work very hard in term time, and I'm very conscious of keeping myself on an even keel and making sure that I get my little bits of just desserts or whatever. And I find it a burden. I find that a burden. I find it a burden not going and seeing pupils that I should be seeing, despite the fact that I live, or not that I should be, but I feel like I should be, just because I live in the same house. And then I,
because you're in loco parentis kind of thing, and
yeah, absolutely, and in geographical locus as well, as in nearby, and I feel guilty about that, and I think, and that burden is weighs quite heavy on my mind. And there's only so much that you can do, and you have to accept your limitations. And also, part of the advantages of boarding are allowing the children to work out how to make their journey in a boarding house where there are three adults and 62 children of different ages. So that's all part of it, and it's a difficult thing. But I do think I'm in my fourth year here, and I do think that I find that something I need to unpack. And really, and
it's, well, this, and it, it's interesting. This study kind of goes from birth to three, because that's obviously you know, when you talk about attachment to parents, in terms of, there's a whole theory on this, isn't there, in terms of, you've got from birth to three to form that close attachment with your parents and form stable relationships and do all that kind of stuff, and there's all kinds of stuff that happens after birth, postnatal depression, you know, dad's not being there or not knowing how to cope, there's all kind, you know, strains of relationships, everything like that. But it was interesting because there's a post which I can't share easily, because it's actually I on Patreon, I back someone called Quinn Norton. Have you come across her?
I have not.
Quinn Norton writes on all kinds of awesome stuff to do with the internet, but she was, bear with me because I'll loop it back to what we're talking about here. She has had the lower part of her back replaced with, you know, surgical intervention, and the painkillers that she was given, like paracetamol and tramadol and stuff, didn't work. And so the doctor, this is in the US, went straight to fentanyl, which is it's even stronger than heroin and morphine and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So she is now physically dependent on this drug. And she wrote this whole post on the difference between physical dependency and addiction, because she's written a lot about addiction and she knows people who are addicted. And I think her mother was a heroin addict and all this kind of stuff. So she says, addiction is a complicated illness with physical, emotional, and psychosocial elements. What's happening to me is much simpler. The fentanyl took over various functions of my body, like releasing endorphins to manage pain, and my body stopped doing those things for itself. The body always seeks equilibrium, and that means if something else is supplying a lot of signaling via neurotransmitters or hormones, your body will stop releasing them or stop accepting them or both. And so I was thinking about that. I was thinking about stimulation, and I was thinking about endorphins, and I was thinking about self-regulation, and I was thinking about the number of times, and again this is anecdotal, that I see kids kicking off in coffee shops I go and work in on a regular basis, because I go and work in coffee shops a few times every week, and they kick off and the parent, almost always male or female, young or old, will give the kid some kind of device to shut them up. And if that's the coping strategy, and the kid is getting like amazing like stimulation from this thing, and they're being shut up by screens quite a lot, it's no wonder that more and more kids are being diagnosed with ADHD. And that's my simple view of it, and it might be a lot more complicated than that, but that's what it seems to me.
I think it's I think that's a fair assessment. I probably want to debate the idea of it being a crude analysis and the, you know, saying there's a causal relationship between gadget parenting and, or gadget nannies, as it were, and ADHD. I think it's a big ask, but I can see what you're saying, and I certainly agree about, as we discussed before on Tide, I agree with the idea that phones are some of the best thing that young people are ever going to touch, and that's an issue. That they are, even though, you know, they are consistent, and they are beautiful, they're full of 16.5 million colors,
but they're designed for addiction. That's the thing.
Exactly. But they're designed for humans, you know. So I think that's kind of fair enough. Yeah.
Before we started recording, but I was away last week and whatever, and we've made the decision, and it's not like one big thing, but lots of little things. We've taken my son's smartphone off him, and he's not being given it back. And actually, his behavior when he hasn't got it, like, he's not a badly behaved child, but he knows that his behavior is worse when he, like, sneaks around the place and goes on YouTube all the time. And I've got no problem with him pushing boundaries. You know, he was wanting to listen to lots of rap music before, and, you know, he's exploring stuff. But at the same time, I feel like life's hard enough as an 11-year-old without having it all mediated by something which is designed to make you addicted to it. Which makes me sound very conservative, but actually I want to kind of help him out. And I think that I'll treat this whole thing a lot differently with my daughter, who's 7. So Ben's had a smartphone since he was 9, and he's had it confiscated on and off and blocked in certain ways and whatever. And I think what I do now is, like, my daughter probably won't be getting a smartphone until she's 12, probably, which is when he'll probably get a new one.
Okay, Ben, if you're listening, if you give me a call, I'll tell you how to crack your dad's password.
While we're talking about passwords, actually, I came across a guy called Jonathan Poets, and he was talking about, so he has lectured on, he's a maths professor, he's lectured on security, he's got friends who work for the NSA, and he doesn't carry a smartphone at all. This is a guy who has recently had tattoos of Linux-related things on his arm. Really cool guy, really knows his stuff. And he was
Hang on. You can't say that. You can't say a guy, right, has had tattoos of Linux-related stuff done on him recently, and then in the same sentence or phrasing, say he's a really cool guy. That's up for debate.
How dare you? I use Linux.
I haven't met anyone with Linux tattooed on their body.
Well, he interestingly got.
He might be cool, but that's not why he's cool.
Right. Okay. He gets a tattoo for every significant project that he finishes. So.
Okay, yeah. I see.
Anyway, I asked him why he doesn't carry a smartphone and all this kind of stuff. And we got talking about security, and interestingly, he wasn't rude, but he was quite cagey about when I asked him, oh, like, what kind of plugins and security measures do you take? He basically didn't tell me. Apart from, he did say that he uses dice-generated passwords, which I remember reading on the EFF website, so I've just put it in the show notes. Now, the idea here is that you get EFF's long word list, which is just a massive text file, and it says, step one, roll 5 dice all at once. Note the faces that come up without looking at the word list yet. Your result, then step two, your results might look like this, reading left to right, 4, 3, 4, 6, 3, you know, on the face of the dice. Write those numbers down. Open up the word list and find the corresponding word next to 43,463, and you'll find the word panoramic. That's step four. This is your first word in the passphrase, so write it down. And then you repeat steps 1 to 4, 5 more times, and you end up with a total of 6 words, and then your passphrase might look something like this: panoramic, nectar, pre-cut, Smith, banana, hand clap. And then you come up with a mnemonic, step six, like a story or a scenario or a sentence that helps you remember your phrase. Like the panoramic view as I tasted the nectar of a pre-cut Granny Smith apple and banana deserved a hand clap. And it says that this passphrase is one of about 2^77 alternatives that could have been chosen by this method. And this guy, Jonathan, did this with entropy of he did it 10 times to increase the entropy of it. So this is amazing.
Well, no, right. It is and it isn't. It's almost like, yeah, it's not. I get what you're saying, and you need to be secure, right? But that's going overboard a little bit. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it is,
right? So let me say why. I'm going to change my master password soon, because my master password isn't actually very secure at all. So I use something called LessPass, which we've talked about before. It's a deterministic password generator, which means that you type in the name of the website. So in this case, like EFF. And you have to remember whether you say EFF.org. I never put the www in or the .org. I just put like EFF. Then you log in, which might be your username or your email address. And then you put your master password in and you press generate and it creates the password specific to that website. Now, obviously, that means your master password has to be super secure, just like any kind of password manager. In this case, it's not storing the passwords. It's generating them on the fly. So I think it's absolutely a valid way to create a super secure master password.
Yeah, I get that. And it's, I hear what you're saying, right? But when you say to me, it's, you know, one time, it could be any combination of 1 × 2^77. And yeah, you don't need to go further than that, man. Like him doing it 10 times, it's just daft.
Okay, well, doing it as it says on the EFF website, if you're listening to this and you think, you know what, I need a stronger master password than, you know, the name of my spouse and the number 7, then, yeah, you should get on this.
I did have someone today who had password with a capital P, 123 as their password.
Oh, my.
And I had to work out in a social situation where I was doing some training, I had to work out how not to ridicule them. Mm-hmm.
Well, just while we're talking about this, I need to change my master password, but I've changed my mind about biometric stuff getting into devices, because I think that it's better than having some kind of biometric stuff, which you know is only stored in your device and isn't sent anywhere else, is better than having a really weak password. And it's funny, when you're at conferences, you're not looking to try and look at people's passwords, but you see people typing the password for their laptop or sometimes their thing for their phone, and they're the least secure things ever. Whereas having biometric stuff, they would have to physically force you to unlock it. Or if you have a really long PIN code, then on the very rare occasions when you need to type in that PIN code, like when you completely restart your phone, then at least like random people can't get into it very easily.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So I had a conversation with the network manager here that talked. He wanted to up our passwords from 8 characters of you know, complex character thing, the usual Microsoft nonsense, up to 16. And the reason he wanted to do this is that brute force attacks were available. Software to do brute force attacks were available to be cracked up to 9 characters, any character combination of 9 characters, in 6 hours. So that was pretty standard, and so he wanted to up it to 8, and I said, well, why not up it to 10? And he says, well, 9 is possible, so 10 can't be that far away. Okay, can you give, and I was hesitant about it. And the reason I'm hesitant about it, you see, is because in an organization, you're forever having to enter your password. You have to do it a lot. So no matter how you set up your machines, whether you're connecting to Wi-Fi or whether you're doing this, that, and the other, and the longer your password is, and lots of our children have really long passwords, so I'm always like, wow, when I see them typing them in. And so my question to the network manager was, can you give me one example in the history of the school of a password being cracked that is done that way, like through brute force rather than some form of social engineering? And and he couldn't. So and so I do think it's about balance and risk, and also, so you know, to have a really, really long password when you're connecting to things often is unnecessary. I think it's just irritating and annoying, which is why biometrics become important.
Do you use the two factor? Google has, within the last, I guess, year, much improved the two factor authentication. Like you just tap a button saying yes, it's me logging in on your Google account. Do you do that?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's changed me from having like a random password for my Google account to an easy, memorable one for all of my Google accounts, each one separate, and then just tapping the yes, it's me logging in on my phone, because doing that is actually more secure than having a very long password.
Yes. No, two factors. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'd agree. You see,
so you can have who was it? Somebody, I think it was like a tech journalist, published his Google password or his Twitter password or something, but had two-factor authentication on, and no one could crack it because you physically have to have the device present.
That's quite brave of him. Or not, actually, when you know how things work. So in my opinion, right, so unless you're working in somewhere where somebody might try to take you down, and as a teacher, I guess that is possible, that you are, and you do need to have a sort of decent level of security and passwords for your staff, and all our kits encrypted and whatever. And and that's important. But I just don't think it's worth getting too hung up about. I'm quite pleased that, I mean, I do agree with the principle that a string of words, unrelated words, is better than using different kinds of characters in your password.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think I do.
Well, just to say that the reason why it's important is that they can, let's just say that you have the least secure person within your organization. And it could be the person at the top, it could be the person at the bottom, it could be, in your case, a pupil, a member of staff, it could be a parent with an account, it could be a peripatetic teacher, I don't know. But they can then use it to then trade up, if you see what I mean, and to get access eventually to your database, because you can spoof the kind of whatever. I'll tell you, actually, on this, while we're talking about security, my wife got a text message from HSBC, and it was from the number that HSBC usually use to send SMS messages. But it was a website that she gave her pause for thought. It was hsbc-personal.org, not a one that she's ever seen before. Okay. And she asked me, what should I do here? So I didn't click on the link. I just went to the website, and then I did a who is. So if you haven't done this before, you don't have to be super techie. You type in who is into your favorite search engine, and you use a who is search to type in the name of the URL, and you see who's behind it. Lo and behold, 3 days before, some random person in a country I've never even heard of had registered this domain. And when I phoned up HSBC to inform them of this, I was in a queue like a million miles long because everyone else had got it too. And presumably some people had tried to log in. It did look very convincing, I have to say. So that, you know, there's people trying to do this all of the time. So I feel like that people talk about attack surfaces. It's an attack surface of your whole organization, not just, you know, us being, I'm not saying that you are, Di, but us being smug and saying that our security practices are up to date and fine.
No, you can call me smug if you want. I don't mind. I agree. There are things about what you're saying, and it is sensible. You see, it's much more sensible to talk to people about checking URLs of sites that you're going to put sensitive information into, than it is of anything else. And yes, they are, you know, people who are creating, who are phishing or sending spam emails are creating better and better emails. We've just discussed before about ransomware. And they're getting better at it, and they are going to get better at it. Why? Because it's going to make them money, and it's and that's what they're trying to do, and potentially. And you really just need to be aware of what your banking URLs are, and what any URL that you put your password into that you're on the legit site, especially ones like banking, like email, social media possibly as well, because people are looking to get your accounts.
I've come across people, and again, it's your whole organization, the security practice, the whole organization. We do focus on passwords too much. But it's access to things which are then going to cause a problem, give people access to information they shouldn't have. So, for example, let's say that you give staff access to email on their own personal mobile devices. And because it's their own personal mobile device, you can't enforce them having a PIN code. So they don't have a PIN code on the mobile phone at all. So you can just swipe to unlock and you can get access to all their email, which means that someone could pretend to be them and do it. And it sounds...
I hear what you're saying, right? Yeah. But the thing that you just said doesn't exist. So all Google, Microsoft email provision services, so Exchange and Gmail, enforce security on your phone and remote wipe facility as well.
They enforce it if you add that account to your Android phone, for example, but they don't enforce it if you are accessing via IMAP or on the web version or whatever.
Not on the web version, no. Everything else they do. So just
I guess what I'm saying is that you're right. It's not about, let's have a conversation about how long your password should be.
I agree. The point being, that's the thing that I would argue, you see, is that you spend time talking about security on this level, and really what you should be talking about is the security of individual people and how you audit that.
Yeah.
That's what I would argue. Right. And how you punish it as well.
No, absolutely. I think, especially in the light of GDPR, because the school or the organization will be punished. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, and the Data Protection Act's been there for years and years, and I don't know of one school that's ever been prosecuted under the Data Protection Act.
Yeah.
So we will see what's going to give with that. They become very unpopular very quickly if they did, but they have prosecuted like crazy people, not crazy people. They've been crazy in the way that they prosecuted those persecuting people who are just really trying to provide a service to sort of niche communities or whatever. And like a guy who sent out the newsletter to the organ magazine subscription thing, which was just a desktop published black and white newsletter of him trying to keep people who are interested in church organs connected. And he got fined £3,500. He was a pensioner for Pete Beck. So the information commissioner's office doesn't always get it right, in my opinion. It'll be interesting to see what happens on the GDPR.
I think so,
which is a good thing. I'm a fan of the GDPR, I'm afraid, as it stands. We'll wait to see how it gets executed.
Anyway, what can dreams of a communist robot utopia teach us about human nature?
Okay, I am going to write a list. Oh no, I'll read a post about it. Dreams of a communist robot utopia teach us about human nature.
I'll summarize this because it's a long, slightly philosophical post on one of my favorite websites, which are kind of online magazines, which is Aeon, which I really should support financially. It's fantastic. I think it's a registered charity as well. So I'll just summarize it quickly. Basically, after the Second World War, Bulgaria, a communist country, went from being one of the world's largest or a massive producer of cigarettes to being one of the world's largest producers of computers. And although I don't put it in this post as a summary, basically they went around the world nicking ideas, buying facilities, and just finding out information as best they could. And they were producing all these computers. And of course, as a result of that, it really changed what people were talking about and what people were employed to do and that kind of thing, which had a knock-on effect on the sci-fi, which was written by Bulgarian authors. And so this guy, Lubyan Dilov, who was this popular sci-fi author, said the article says that he focused on the boundaries between man and machine, brain and computer. And all of these books were kind of full of societies obsessed with technology. And it kind of mirrors what's happening now with all of the stuff that's happening about robots taking jobs and AI and everything like that and deep fakes and that kind of stuff. But the interesting thing is we're kind of less bothered about some Blade Runner style dystopia, but we're more concerned about what constitutes kind of digital reality. And I just thought it was a really nice post because this last bit where he says, the author says, quote, Bulgarian robots were both to be feared and they were the future. Socialism promised to end meaningless labor, but reproduced many of the anxieties that are still with us today in our ever automating world. What can man do that a machine cannot is something we still haven't solved. But like Kestorovsky, perhaps we need not fear this new world so much, nor give up our reservations for the promise of a better, easier world. End of quote.
Wow. Okay. That's, I don't know what to make of it.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because I've also done something this week, which I haven't written about, which talks about how, you know, not very long ago, computers were getting, you know, image recognition wrong kind of about 30% of the time. And that wasn't very long ago. And that's kind of useless. You know, when the computer gets things wrong 3 times out of 10, you're like, well, that's just not great. It's a bit like, you know, in the early days of when we were trying to teach using the internet at school, and I can remember the internet connection would go down at least once a week. And you think, well, I can't plan my lesson if it might go down during my lesson and stuff. And you can't be bothered to back up. So
just going to say,
it's now computers can spot and can get things right and recognize things and only get things wrong about 5% of the time, which is about the same as human beings. So, you know, you think, oh, well, there's now human being and an AI parity. They're about the same. But of course, that's not true because a computer can recognize about 200,000 objects a second, whereas a human being can spot one.
Yeah, but I think that's, I mean, it's all good.
I hope so.
Computers are going to be used to do that kind of thing. And it's hard to say what society will look like in 20 years' time, even really, or certainly 50. And I think there is going to be more tech and there are going to be these issues. We are going to be talking more about utopia, dystopia, socialism, you know, where machines... You know, we've talked before where there are people that exist already that can't earn more money than a machine. So why would you employ a person to do the work? And it's going to be interesting to see how society unfolds with all of these things. It's going to be really, really difficult, and there's going to be lots of societal unrest, civil unrest, I'd have thought, in our future. I don't know. I live in a bit of a bubble here, I think, and it's very hard to get a feeling for what's going on in the streets. I've lived in the city for a long time, and it was much easier in that regard to see what was happening to individuals.
Are you optimistic that when? I mean, I suppose you teach at a expensive boarding school, but are you confident that there's going to be enough out there?
Enough what out there?
Sorry, enough like jobs.
Good people.
And stuff for people to
jobs. No, I'm not. I'm not confident about jobs. I don't think that's right. I think it's quite interesting. I do think that. Right. So I don't think society is a conspiracy, particularly. I think it's an evolution, and it grows that way for reasons. But what it does do is it. Things that fascinate me are like the cracking of prejudice long term, like the Windrush stuff that's been going on this week is amazing. It's amazing listening. Who's the MP? Is it David Lammy standing up in Parliament and giving his speech about Windrush? Just absolutely fascinating. Because it's about damn time. There is no British history without the Empire. Blah, 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 blah. Yep. Absolutely bang on. And we shouldn't be teaching, you know, when we teach about slavery in this country, we teach about Wilberforce and the ending of slavery, abolition. of slavery, when William Wilberforce is very recognised in Hull, actually, where I was for my father's birthday. But we should be talking about, if you're going to talk about British history, you need to talk about the British people enslaving people from other countries. You need to talk about that. You need to explore it. You need to look at what life was like for the slaves, because it doesn't really form much of the pattern of the historical education that goes on in the country. I mean, you must have an angle on that.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because, like, there's obviously so much history. I'm reading a fantastic book at the moment. I just started last night about the looting of Peruvian artifacts. And that might sound really arcane, but it's written. It was a book from 2004, written in a wonderful style, and talking about how poor Peruvian peasants were basically being encouraged to loot these big, tall things, which had all these... they were basically mounds, which had all this amazing jewels and inside by antiquities collectors around the world. And you're looking at it, and it's like, oh, it's kind of a free market thing. And then the author goes into it and how things have changed since there've been local airports, and you can shift things quickly, and everyone's connected, etc. And then you realize, you come across this guy in the book who was a museum curator, and I can't pronounce his name, but he was saying that part of it stems from this kind of colonial attitude towards Peruvian people, which just treats them as, you know, people to be exploited for rich people who collect stuff, and how that has been the case since the Spanish came and took over, and how there's just no respect for the history of, you know, Peruvian civilizations prior to this, which, you know, doesn't stop people from, you know, modern day Peruvian people. This book was in 2004, so 14 years ago, but kind of looting their ancestors for all of this stuff. And you see this everywhere, just this kind of colonial attitude. And it's extremely difficult as a white guy to really get the depth of how much people like us historically have, you know, just institutionalized misogyny and racism to the extent that, you know, when I advertise a job this week and all of the most qualified people so far who come through are middle-aged white guys, you think, well, they're just the most qualified people. But the institutional stuff, which means that is the case, is almost incredible to even think about. Like, even to try and unpack is just...
it's incalculable. That's what it is. It's incalculable,
yes.
Yes. And I think for me, Doug, this is... so, well, like, when people, you know, like, you go... like the pyramids, or you go to a big castle or something like that, all I really think about is who are the poor fuckers that lived in misery to get this built. That's all I ever really think about. So it's like I find it, and I've had this conversation with different people in the past, and it's a difficult thing, and really it's a pleasure to go and be able to see why these things were built and the achievements of society. But I often think that and the Lammy speech made me reflect on this, really, is that we just look at, you know, you look back over time and you see things through rose-tinted glasses. You know, hindsight, it doesn't bring clarity. Hindsight hides struggle, is what it does. And people suffer, and it doesn't get accounted for. And it doesn't, it's just not in the story. It just disappears somehow. It evaporates. And it's really, really sad. And I think the things you're saying there, that's exactly right. Because what are you supposed to go and do? Who is going to take up the responsibility to say, right, I am not going to appoint the most qualified person for the job. I am going to deal with the institutional shite that our world has created. Who stands up and says that? No one does. The police did a little bit after Stephen Lawrence, and they did very positive discrimination acts within the police force, which were uncomfortable for many for a long time. The television shows about it and news reports about it and all sorts of things. And but over time, it does start to have an impact, does start to make change happen. It's a very, very difficult thing.
Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer Prize for music?
I did see that, yes.
So this is a huge deal because this is the kind of stuff which is usually won by kind of classical composers and whatever. And it's interesting because my son, who's 11, has been asking to listen to rap music. And a lot of rap music, as I'm sure you're aware, can be hugely misogynistic and glorifying of gang violence and just some of the worst attitudes you'd want in society. Whereas Kendrick Lamar, okay, he swears every now and again, and you know, some of the things he talks about in terms of women aren't like amazing, but at the same time, he's got this story to tell through his music and through his lyrics, especially, that really tells the other side of the picture, you know, being kind of African-American. So I was really pleased. And actually, the only thing that I'm going to put on my son's MP3 player is Kendrick Lamar's soundtrack to the Black Panther film, because I think that has got, not only is it fantastic musically, but actually it's kind of telling a story of marginalization, which hopefully Ben will imbibe, because when I was his age, I had a copy of Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style album on cassette, which I listened to when I was out to my parents' kind of control, when I was doing my paper round and stuff. And that was extremely disrespectful of women, and very glorifying of gang violence. And so I feel like I want to separate the music from the culture in some way. Although that sounds ridiculous. You see what I mean? Like I want to be very careful about the kind of stuff that I kind of encourage him towards. Because otherwise, I don't want him to go through the kind of teenage years that I had, where the culture, you know, FHM, Loaded, Lads Mags, Page Three Girls, rap music, hip hop, but the kind of stuff which just gives you a background of, even though you haven't gone out of your way to have certain attitudes towards minorities or women or whatever, just that's the kind of stuff that you grew up surrounded by. And it takes a long time to unlearn that kind of stuff, I would say.
I think it's, I mean, the really difficult thing is that childhood in the modern age is a double bind, straightforwardly. You know, as a human being, you know how to treat people well, you know what the right thing to do is, but you don't get treated right and you hear all these stories. You know, you tell your daughter to go and dress up well, and then you'll watch Beyonce on the telly dressed in nout, or whatever, you know. And it's all kind of cool, and she's the thing that everybody's talking about is on the television, you know. That's, well, what do mum and dad know, for Pete's sake? I want to wear as little as I can. And Beyonce's possibly not a good example in this regard. But it's certainly out there, you know, and similarly with male attitudes and that sort of thing. So the successful musicians who are talking about what's going on in their lives, like Kendrick Lamar, possibly. Yeah. But I would argue that, so I think the only thing to do is exactly the same thing as with everything that we talk about, which is to talk about it. So you listen to Kendrick Lamar, listen to it with Ben, and you talk about it, and you say, God, he just said that. What does that mean? Is that okay? Is it okay that he says that? What do you think?
That's exactly what we did. I said, did you hear what he said there? He was like, what? I said, he used the word nigger. He's like, what does that mean? And I explained about it being a derogatory term and stuff. And he's like, well, why is he using it? And we talked about, you know, calling women bitches and hoes and all that kind of stuff. But it's exactly the conversation. I'm not saying I'm a model parent, but it's exactly the kind of conversation I would never have had with my parents, and they wouldn't have even been prepared to have it. But yeah, it just makes it very difficult.
So is it a good thing that you're having it, do you think? Can you detach yourself from it and think, well,
stay down with the kids and listen to all that music, I think.
Well, I mean, there is that, and there is, but we have a responsibility to consume the media that our children consume, I think, and which my parents certainly didn't do. They would just like get that off. I would live in, you know, my parents grew me up, love them as I do, in a world where they did not participate in. Mm. You know, they did not see the world in the same way I did. They did not have access.
Going back to what you said before about, like, you know, living in a boarding school and carving out space for your own when you feel like you have this responsibility, this in loco apprentice kind of thing for the kids there. It's the same, you know, living in a house with kids and things. Like, you have to have your own stuff as well. And when you're working every day and whatever, like, you have to listen to the music that you like and watch the things that you like and, you know, that kind of thing. And
I think it's true. And it gets harder as your children get older, and you have to find compromises to all of that. You know, you have to find common ground. It's not easy, I don't think. And the only way to do it actually is to say, right, that's yours. Kendrick Lamar is yours, Ben. This is mine. And we're going to listen to one of them and one of these kind of thing, because we're in the same room together and our relationship is mutual, not one way kind of thing.
Not being imposed. Yeah.
It's like sort of thing. And I don't know. But the other problem is that, I mean, for Ben, if you look at Ben, right? So he lives in that difficult place at the moment, I guess, where... your world is his world, but now he's starting to put a foot outside of that, and he's starting to say, well, actually, this is my world, and this isn't really my parents' world. They don't know my friends. They don't know the conversations that we have. They don't, you know, they know them, but they don't, you know, it's not the same. And he's sort of exploring and looking around the world and sort of thinking, my God, this is what's going on, and what should I be in this? What is this? What is part of me with, well, my mum and dad, they're like this, and they're cool, that's all fine. But it's all this other stuff.
The word he used, but yes, absolutely.
I hear what you're saying. But he will think that in time, you know. And it's an interesting experience for a young person, I think, to sort of think, well, what is my position in this society that's presenting to me? And in that is included all of the media, not the media just that we consume or sanitize or, you know, judge to be okay, but all of the media and all of the people's opinions and the things that are going on, the snippets of life that they pick up in their footsteps. And how they interpreted that is really, really difficult. So it always comes back to the idea, well, just come talk to me about it. So even in the confiscation of his phone, you're making a massive judgment on him, and you're going to have to work out. So you're sheltering him, and he's going to be very conscious of that. So he's going to be happy about it at first, but that's going to change for him over time. You're going to face pressures and conversations that are going to not be that easy to have. How much do you hide him from that other people his age are being and in his walk of life are experiencing, and he's not getting?
No, and it's already like you know those who have got older siblings, like, obviously have
absolutely
wider open and whatever. The thing I find difficult, I was listening to From Our Own Correspondent today, and it was talking about, again, kind of Syria and how difficult it is to even know what's really happening, because people are spinning different stories and claiming fake news and all that kind of stuff. And I'm a big fan of memes, as you know, and I use them in my TEDx talk, my thesis, in the ebook and things. And I don't know, did you see, like, I have zero interest in the machinations of the royal family, but what I did find hilarious was, did you see the town crier outside the hospital where whatever she's called gave birth to the latest royal sprog?
Yes, she's called Kate Middleton, and she has given birth to the fifth in line to the throne, which is of huge significance to no one.
Right. So this guy, a town crier, everyone presumed he was an official guy, and he wasn't.
Oh, right, really? He just rocked up, did he?
Yeah, and he was dressed in all of the, you know, finery, and was ringing a bell, and... yeah, everyone just crack on. And he was on the BBC News. And then obviously, because he looked quite dramatic, he was turned into a meme. And so there's some quite funny ones there, like him shouting, looking like he's shouting, ringing a bell, saying, "May I remind you, this is a library," someone's captioned it.
I like the other one. And finally, I would like to remind the public that I never watched those films, despite the £900 bill from Virgin Media.
And there's a whole list of them, and they're just great. But yeah, we live in a world like that, which is both funny, but also it must be very, like, there's no firm ground to stand on if you're a child in this area.
No, I think, but this is the thing, you see, and then that's partly what everyone is scared about with the internet, is if you're not in it, you can't see it, and you're not sure what's going on. Hmm. And the truth is that most adults don't have a clue. you know, no, that's as you right. said about,
which is why it's very difficult to teach the next generation, because they either don't want to know or they're not aware of the stuff that they don't know. And I'm not saying that I am, but I know enough to be concerned that I don't know enough.
Yeah, well, there you go. And so you get, I'll tell you something, like a fascinating story from the last few weeks is the North Korea one. Right, what the hell is going on there? So you got Trump and what is it, Kim Jong-un or whatever, mouthing off at each other, facing off at each other across the world, you know, via Twitter or whatever, and then all of a sudden Trump goes to visit him and everything's okay. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, do you know, it felt very set up, didn't it? It felt like this guy can't go
question
it with a person from South Korea, so we're gonna have to set up some kind of narrative.
Yeah, no, it's completely orchestrated. There's nothing genuine in it whatsoever. But the question is actually, what is going on? Do you know what I mean? What is the genuine story? Because who knows? How can you tell? Because it's so, so hidden. And
I think we need a new way of doing democracy or a different type of governance. But until we've got that, my view is that we democratically elect people to deal with all this crap. And that I want to know what's happened, not what might happen, and what someone's thinking about what might happen, because that to me isn't news.
Well, I had this, my mother, bless her, last night over dinner said, what was it? I started talking about the Windrush thing a little bit, not a lot. I don't like to get very political with my parents because I spent my youth doing that. And it always ends in tears. But So I said the thing about the Windrush thing. She says, yeah, and it goes all the way back, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. Theresa May was like, no, it goes all the way back to that Blair fella. And I'm like, okay, explain that for me then. And she said, well, in 2008, I said, well, Tony Blair was elected in 1997, he was in power for 10 years. So that's 2007, he stood down. Well, who was next then? It was him, that Gordon Brown. I'm like, what did they do then? What did they do, Mum? And I said, Theresa May, she changed that all the Windrush that you had to have citizenship. The whole point of Windrush is that Theresa May changed the policy when she was Home Secretary that to get NHS treatment you must provide proof of citizenship, and everybody who came over at that point has no proof of in the 50s 60s, has no proof of citizenship, and which has been in the press recently, and well done to the Guardian for their investigative journalism once again. And that's what she did. This goes back to her. It does not go back any further. I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I was just like, so come on, tell me then, what is it? Well, I don't know, but someone said, or I read it somewhere or something. Well, I said, that's not good enough. You can't say that. You have to be able to tell me at least something that somebody actually did that indicates that what you're saying is true. And she said,
exactly.
Oh.
And the thing is, because there's so much stuff happening. There's Alain de Botton's book, just called The News, is great on this. Just like the news doesn't care about what happened yesterday. It's just the ever present. And so outlets are happy to, you know, an analyst and futurists and people who are predicting stuff are happy to completely contradict what they said yesterday. And it's just the ever present. And so you can never really know enough about what's going on. And there's people who are trying to misdirect you. So I think just don't bother.
I don't think that. You see, I think something different. I think if you give a shit, go find out. That's what I think. So it's like I was trying to say to my mum last night.
Give a shit about everything, right?
No, but I'm not saying give a shit about everything. I'm saying where you care about something enough, you need to go and read about it and find some sources and corroborate the information that you're told. So that if you're going around and passing on a point of view to other people in the world, that you can substantiate that at least with some fact. But also at that point, as I was with my mother last night, prepared to sort of say, can you tell me something different that I can go away and read about and change my perspective on this? Because this is what I think and this is why I think it. And if you've got more information for me, I'm happy to hear it and I'm happy to be wrong or be educated better. I just kind of thought, I think we do have a responsibility to do that. So I don't comment on Syria to anyone because I really don't understand what the hell is going on there. You know, and there are many things like that in life. And all I can say is that I know for the facts that I feel I know, therefore can't be facts. The knowledge I feel like I have about Syria is that a lot of people have suffered and there's a lot of pain and terrible things have happened in that country in the last, I'm not even so sure how long, it keeps changing the length in things that I read. You know, it's really hard to nail, you know, the last 5 years, last 10 years, I'm not quite sure what's going on. And so I don't have any facts about that other than I know the people there must be suffering greatly. Mm. A lot of people have been suffering greatly. Like, I know there's a shortage of water in South Africa, and I think that's a fact. Because people told me, you've been there. Do you know what I mean? There are certain facts about things going on in the world that you can rely on.
So this week in the UK, there is the first Flat Earth conference to being held in the UK. There's you know how people are flat earthers, and there's been a bit of
absolutely. Yeah.
There was now a conference this week in the UK on people who genuinely disbelieve that the world is round, spherical.
And you think, there's not.
No, there is. There is. It was in the news.
Yeah, no, but there's not. I mean, there will be, like, yeah, there's, like, you know, there's a couple of hundred people live in the UK, or 80 million, whichever you prefer. And some of them are going to think some really crazy crap, and you're going to be able to go and find them. But telling me that there's people who think that the earth is flat, mm-hmm. they're not in my life. We don't get them to talk at my school. I don't.
Right, and that's the other thing as well. Like, we give airtime to people with crazy ideas because
we like to be outraged. As long as they're seen as crazy. As long as it's, you know, when spaghetti grows on trees, spaghetti grows on trees. Do you know what I mean? The most likelihood thing is it's going to be is an April Fool's joke, you know, and that's it. And it's like,
I'm trying to find a way of linking this to a wonderful post I read, and I tried to summarize about the kind of the cultural value of memes. So there's this really long blog post or an article from Jay Owens, and He's talking about the relationship between memes, fake news, and what he calls kind of post-authenticity. And it's this really long post, and it's got different sections. And I think the reason it's got different sections is that it's not one long flowing argument. It's kind of different sections. So I'm interested in the bit towards the end, because he talks about the power of memes and why they're kind of like the perfect form of online cultural expression. And the reason he says this, so I'll just give an example. He says, so through humor, exaggeration, and irony, a truth emerges about how people are actually feeling, a truth that they may not have felt able to express straightforwardly. And there's just as much and potentially more community present in these groups as in many of the more traditional civic-oriented groups Zuckerberg's strategy may have had in mind. So he's talking about people sharing memes as a way of expressing stuff that they wouldn't be able to express directly. And so what he's talking about is the empathetic nature of memes, which I think is fantastic and something which seems to be almost an entirely new form, which the internet allows us to do.
I think so. So I think memes are great. I think some of the best work I've ever done is the memes that I put out for Internet Safety Week. I just think it was genius. Pat on the back for me, or maybe. And the reason that I felt that way, I think, is that I felt that it was a very clear and straightforward way to talk to only the pupil body, not to the teachers, not to the staff. They wouldn't really get them. They wouldn't get how funny they were and how gentle they were in comparison to their potentially to the other counterparts, sort of thing. And the real things on the internet. And it was just a great way. And I do think there is...
There's a form of ambiguity in there, isn't there? There's a form of, you're not saying something directly. And he says about this, he talks about it being like a Trojan horse. He says the format acts as a kind of Trojan horse for sharing difficult feelings because the format primes the audience to respond hospitably. There isn't that moment of feeling stuck over how to respond to a friend's emotional disclosure because she hasn't made the big statement directly, but instead through irony and cultural quotation, distancing herself from the topic through memes, typically by using stock photography rather than anything as gauche as a picture of oneself. This enables you, the viewer, to sidestep the full intensity of it in your response, should you choose, but still crucially to respond. And also to DM your friend and ask, hey, are you all right? And cut to the real talk, should you choose to. End of quote.
Yeah, no, I think that's bang on. The point being is that I think human beings and communications between them are that complicated and sophisticated. And the memes do provide a very simple and straightforward way of doing those things, of sort of putting yourself out there but hiding at the same time, doing it in a gentle manner, and that kind of thing. And giving the opportunity for those that care to say hello, you know.
And it's the when I was talking about digital literacies and things, it's the kind of, this is the cultural bit I'm talking about, in terms of you could totally take things at surface value, but there's layers and layers and layers of this, especially if you've got a relationship. So as I've said before, I've got a back channel with you on Signal when it works. I've got a permanent back channel with my wife on Telegram. And, there's things on there which are kind of very personal to us, which recur. And so I might share a picture of whatever it is, but I don't mean by the picture the thing which I'm sending. I mean that thing, remember at that time when we did that thing. And I'm not saying that directly, but if you remember, then you'll remember this thing that we did, and then what, that kind of thing, you know. Uh-huh. And it's not saying things directly. Now there's a particular meme which is now kind of the favorite of people who study media literacy and this kind of stuff. And it's the American Chopper meme. Have you seen this one?
I have, yes. It's very funny and quite sad.
So if you're listening to this, you'll have to go and have a look at it. And just there's a wonderful website called Know Your Meme, knowyourmeme.com. And knowyourmeme.com kind of looks at when the meme came to prominence, talks about how it evolved, and also kind of looks at, not in too much kind of philosophical and detail, but it does kind of tease it apart for those who are unaware. And this particular one comes from a TV program called American Chopper that I've never seen. And there's a particular scene, which it's a series of screenshots between the dad who owns the business and his son, who was seen as a disappointment by his father, and the son arrives late. And they're shouting at each other. The son throws the chair, and then the dad points his finger at the end. And people have reappropriated this for all kinds of stuff, like trying to putting words in people's mouth around deconstructing the relationship between John and Garfield. They've talked about all kinds of stuff. And then the author, Robin Sloan, tweeted in all capital letters, "This is the only meme format that acknowledges the existence of competing information. And as such, it is the only format suited to the complexity of our world," which I thought was great.
Yes. This meme site's really cool. It kind of breaks them down, looks at their origins, look at their spread and the diversity of how the meme's been applied and that kind of thing. It's kind of cool.
It's really good. So I don't know if you remember, in my TEDx talk, I talked about Success Kid. You've seen that one, haven't you?
I don't remember it. But I do remember your TEDx talk about thingamajigs. I just can't remember Success Kid off the top of my head.
Well, the reason I know about Success Kid and know the history of that is I looked on here and I followed some other sites and stuff as well. But the original photo was taken by a woman of her 11-month-old son in 2007. She put in a Flickr account. And then someone came across it, started photoshopping it, cut out the kid, put it on different stuff. Like, it's just, they take on a life of their own.
Cool. They're really awesome. I mean, memes, that's the thing about memes, is that you just get this whole sort of swirl of different people's senses of humor coming into a focal point. And it just kind of works. It's kind of great.
Well, we're talking right at the top of this episode. We're talking about horses for courses with laptops. And yeah. I feel like, I'll tell you a book that I picked up in Glasgow recently when I was there. I picked up an old battered copy of Clay Shirky's Here Comes Everybody, which must have been written, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to reread this in the light of knowing what happened over the last decade. because I feel like at that time we were talking about almost like a single internet culture. And I feel like, as inevitably would happen, there's lots of different subcultures, there's fragmentation of identities, and some of that's on purpose and some of it's not. And I think it's not all healthy, but it is inevitable that we have different cultures and different ways of representing ourselves online. And we can't possibly know everything that happens in all different corners of the internet. But there are certain things which are common in terms of tropes or in terms of approaches to the web, which are common to all, which is, I guess, some of the stuff we cover on this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just reading this 90s kids will understand meme.
It's hilarious, isn't it? Do you want
to... So it reads like this. I'm going to read it for the listener. Should you be a 90s child? So the things you will understand. Tamagotchis, Pokemon cards, Sony Walkmans, I'd say, but it says men's on here. The crushing realization that you're stuck between a generation of people who believe that hard work could accomplish anything and that you should live your dreams, while the generation that came immediately after you is living far better by being in the right place at the right time and having the foresight to study in newly developed fields, thus leaving you to tend to your hopeless, demolished expectations and dreams for the future. And pogs. I do love that.
And so when I send, what I'm saying in the post is like, when I send,
can I just say that is really, really true. That is me to a T. So my parents' generation before me, their hard work and graft, just get on with it. Oh, shut up, stop your moaning, and just get on with it. Make do. And then the generation now, people work. You know, they go and study things, and that's, you know, they work really hard. Like, you go to university. When I went, it was all about drinking and stuff. I don't know about most people, but
I think it was in the Independent or in the Guardian. They're the only two things I really read. It was saying that on average, if you take everything as an average, as a mean, the average person who works is less well off than the average pensioner.
Yeah, no, I can imagine that's true. I mean, I look at my parents' generation, and you know, they're doing fine.
And if you look at home ownership, if you look at all that kind of stuff, it's very difficult. And when, like, we talked before about how I see myself as the world's oldest millennial, because millennials are people who came to adulthood around the year 2000, which I kind of did, or 1980. But I've got gray hair, and like, I've kind of done okay for myself. And so no one thinks of me as a millennial, but I've still found it very difficult to afford a big enough house for my family, even though I earn reasonable amount of money and stuff. Because if I'd been born 5 years earlier, I would have been able to buy my house for like half the price, you know.
Yeah, no, sorry, I did do that. So, you know, sucks.
Yes. So don't
get my house is double. My house in London has doubled in price.
But just to say that that's kind of meme, which in this case is a bunch of text, but it's as a picture, which you can put in anywhere, obviously not think about the word count. I shared that with my wife, and of course her response was the laughing, crying face. But when you share this kind of stuff on a regular basis, the thing that you're communicating, like I said before, and like the guy Jay Owen says in the post, is the feeling, the empathy, the like, we're in it together, we're part of this group here, which I think is a valuable thing to do.
Certainly.
Yeah. Okay, I don't think we've got time to go through the resume as a poor proxy for a human being. You need more daylight to sleep better and open educational pragmatism. But it's up to you.
No, we don't need to go through them.
Okay.
I agree. The resume is a poor proxy for a human being. You do need more daylight to sleep better. And the last one is not a question. Open educational pragmatism. Or maybe it is. Is that something that we need? I keep thinking about open education. Education is not very open.
No, it's not. Do you think it should be?
I generally think most things should be open and be better for it, including human beings. But I don't know. I don't know necessarily what the purpose of it is. I know you go to these OER events and you've done open education for a while in that regard. I just never think that what I think I mean by open or imagine by open that which I imagine by people sharing resources and talking about things in a kind of legit way, rather than trying to further their careers in that kind of ladder climbing way, but they just tend to be, I don't know what's going on with it. I don't know whether anything good has ever come out of an open educational resource. That's what I wonder. Do you know what I mean? Something.
Well, I don't, like I've said to lots of people before, I don't think any teacher goes, oh, well, now let me search for an open educational resource. What I think we do need is it just to become the norm, so that repurposing, reuse, remix, all the 5 R's that people talk about just becomes part of open educational practice. And I think that the practice is the important thing, not the focus on the resources and stuff. But that's a conversation for another time, perhaps.
Well, maybe it's worth discussing. I think it's something I would like to look at more. But I also think it's connected to higher education rather than secondary education.
Do you? Oh, that's interesting.
I never see it as being part of my gig, really. I just don't see anybody doing my job interested in it at all. Even though I think it's a priority.
I used to. Oh, there we go.
yeah, but...
Right, so what are you up to? No,
More of the same. So hopefully I'll be playing cricket. I did my first cricket match last week. I'm not really a cricket player, but I bowled 3 overs and took a wicket. And two of the overs were quite cheap. So tomorrow we'll play again, and it was quite exciting. I'll tell you one thing I did do, because I work in this privileged school, they have a bowling machine in the cricket nets. Oh, wow. And I've never played cricket, really, and so it was the first time I'd had the opportunity to consistently face like 30, 35 balls in a row, and it really does help, like, develop your skill.
Well, it's deliberate practice, isn't it? You know, I was reading about this, and you know, in Ruud Gullit's kind of autobiography, it's called How to Watch Football. And he was talking about the machine that my dad had experienced in Qatar at the Aspire Academy. And it costs like £1 million. And a bit like tennis balls or cricket balls being fired at you, this one is a massive wall, and footballs will come out at different places, and it lights up, and you have to put it over there. And players like Arjen Robben, Bayern Munich, would spend hours in there every day just working on their reflexes. And last night, Ben, who's now been, my daughter's doing very well. I hardly ever talk about her, but Grace is doing very, very well as well. But Ben's been chosen for the basketball team after only going to 5 practices. And I sometimes think I should just book out the hall and just line up a few basketballs and just get him to keep throwing it towards the hoop. Because that would be a really useful thing to do.
Yeah. Or get a basketball net in your backyard.
Yeah, but then that would be outside my office, which would be very annoying.
You could go and play with him.
I would do, but I work for a living from home.
I know. I'm only taking the piss. I'm just pulling your leg.
Have you got a bank holiday off, or are you working through that?
No, we don't. I don't. Yeah, I'm a teacher. I don't do bank holidays. Or I don't do them here anyway. Do we do bank holidays? Does normal schools do bank holidays?
Yeah, of course.
All right. No, we don't do them here because the children live here.
Okay.
So we'll be teaching on that day.
Okay. Well, I am going up a mountain.
Because
It's been a while, as you know.
Where are you going? I haven't told you this.
We're going to go just to the Cheviots because my wife, Hannah, is going to come with me because she's expressed a desire to come walking with me. And... so we were going to scope the Cheviots, but when I looked on the mountain training website, a reminder to listeners that this is part of the 20 quality mountain days I'm trying to do to get on the course. It didn't seem to be counted as a mountainous area, whereas the Galloway Hills are, and it takes about 3 hours to get there. And so we're going to stay in a little place, not in a youth hostel and things, and be in separate rooms. So we're going to stay in this nice little cottage. We're going to go walking on Sunday and on Monday. So looking forward to that.
That sounds fabulous. So you just walk in, not camping?
No. That'll come later, I think. But just kind of easing her into it, making sure that I do, you know, my 5 hours above a certain height, reasonably challenging conditions, that kind of thing. So it counts as one of those days without putting her off, so she never wants to do it again.
Fair shout. There's so when I was on Gold TV, I got really into that walking crap up high, getting lost, compasses, maps, all that rubbish.
Yeah.
And really enjoyed it. I'm going to do some more stuff of that, I think. I've got the other expedition up in the Peak District, I think, at the end of the summer term.
And you can borrow my login for this if you want to have a play about. The Ordnance Survey have now, they've got all of their maps online on the app and everything like that, which is great. But if you subscribe on a yearly basis, as I do, you also get their kind of online planning tool, which shows you different routes that other people have put on there, the premium routes as well, which are included with the subscription, but also a 3D tool which shows you, and I think I put this on my blog last time I went, this time last year, they were just doing it in beta then, but it's now launched, and you can see where you're going to walk in 3D, like all the bits that are going to be challenging and stuff. And they've just launched their augmented reality version for the phone, so that you can hold your phone up and see where all the different points of interest are and how far it is and everything like that.
Does that mean you don't actually have to go?
There's a different virtually, experience. You know? And also, on this kind of thing that I'm doing, I'm not allowed to just navigate using my phone.
No, absolutely. I would leave your phone at home. Take your phone for photos, whatever, you know.
It's good to check as well. But
Cool. Well, that sounds very exciting. I'm jealous. That sounds great.
I'm looking forward to it. Should be good.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll speak next week when your legs are a little weary and you've had a lovely time.
Yes. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening to episode 101 of Today in Digital Education. And hopefully we'll be able to record for the next few weeks on a Tuesday night. Cheers, everyone.
Bye-bye. At the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay.